You know him, you love him. He's the big guy, Sasquatch. He's known by dozens of different names all over the world. People have been seeing creatures like this for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. He's been seen in every state of this country and on every continent on this planet. Different sizes, different colors, but all sort of having some of the same kinds of characteristics. A humanoid, hairy humanoid figure that has perplexed us and bewildered us for a long time. Is this a solvable mystery? Can we get evidence that would prove it one way or another? Well, David Politis brings his 20 years of law enforcement, investigative and analytical skills to this kind of research. He's written two excellent books about the search for Bigfoot. And when we come back, we'll jump right into the state of Bigfoot research right now. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Last year, I had David Politis on the program to talk about his most recent book, Tribal Bigfoot, and it's pretty impressive. It's impressive work. This is an elusive mystery. It's confounding. It's frustrating. I've been around a long time, and nobody can seem to get to the bottom of it, but David has approached this sort of like a cop would approach it, going out, interviewing the witnesses, following the evidence where it leads. Tell me this, David. We're glad to have you back on the show, by the way.
Well, I'm glad I got with you there, George. I appreciate the offer.
Is this a solvable mystery?
Absolutely. For many years, there's been a lot of people that have taken different venues and ideas trying to understand how they can come to some resolution with it. And from the get-go, we started off understanding that DNA would probably be the solution. And we first tracked to the idea that we wanted to understand what we were dealing with. And the best way to do that, when I look back on my law enforcement career, was utilizing a law enforcement forensic artist to sit down with witnesses and draw exactly what the witness observed. And this hadn't been done before by other researchers. And because of my expertise in dealing in that venue, I knew that a good forensic artist, when they sat down with a witness, would draw exactly what the witness saw. And we chose Harvey Pratt from Oklahoma, and Harvey is the chief forensic artist for the state of Oklahoma, and as of a month ago, he is now the director for the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation. He's a man of incredible integrity and an absolutely outstanding artist, and every time Harvey sits down with somebody, when they're done, they are amazed that Harvey can get this out of them and show exactly what they observed.
And, you know, what struck me the first time I saw his drawings is how human some of these faces look.
And, you know, George, that is something that intrigued us the first night, because there's so many stories out there about this is an ape, this is a gorilla. But then once you start to talk to the Native Americans, and I don't mean just one tribal group, I mean across North America and Canada, of course, you start to listen to what they have to say. And they have never stated that this is an ape or a gorilla. They've always stated that this is another tribe of Native Americans. They look a little different. They act a little different. They're a little more elusive. But they're another tribe of people. And once the drawings started to show consistency, and I'm not talking maybe 5 or 10 drawings. I'm talking dozens and dozens of drawings. And sitting down with the witnesses and listening to their descriptive analysis of their own drawing, it's obvious that these things have some type of genetics that are similar, if not exactly parallel with ours.
I want to, you know, a lot of folks, of course, write this off. They say it's all a hoax. It started in 1958 where somebody hoaxed some guys on a work crew in the forest up there in Northern California, created these tracks, and it's, you know, sort of developed a life of its own ever since. There have been hoaxed films and hoaxed footprints and things of that sort. I thought the most interesting, some of the most interesting parts of your book, Tribal Bigfoot, is the historical research that goes way, way back, long before there were any kind of media, mass media influence telling people to believe in Bigfoot.
Absolutely. And people don't even have to purchase the book to see some type of historical revelation. If you go to our website, and there's a segment there on the Tule River Indian Reservation in sort of south central California near Fresno. And they have an area right next to a river that archaeologists have dated it back almost 1,500 years. And the pictures are on the website of what the drawings are that this tribe put on these rocks. And they look just like Bigfoot. And when you talk to the elders, they say, yep, Our ancestors drew these because they were caretakers of the woods. They took care of us. They kept the grizzly bears away, and they took care of our tribe. And darn, if you don't look at those drawings and you say, well, 1,500 years ago, these people were drawing exactly what we're seeing today. And there's a consistency down along the lines. You know, even in the 1700s, there are newspaper articles about big, hairy monsters or big, hairy people that were chasing others and stealing livestock.
Isn't there a story about Teddy Roosevelt having an encounter?
There absolutely is, yeah. And talks about a couple of guys that were trappers that were down in a river, and one of them got taken apart, essentially dismembered. And he talks about another time where he was on a trip, and he heard a shriek and a sound that he and the other people he were with, which were trappers and guides, had never heard before and didn't understand it and couldn't put it with any animal that was known in the woods.
Going back to the historical records, you came across this resource, this book from 1916 by a Yurok woman named Lucy Thompson. Tell us about that.
Well, that fits so sweetly into where I was working predominantly. I was up near the Hoopa Indian Reservation up in Northern California. I'd made good friends there, and it was just a good base of knowledge. It's about 30 miles south of Bluff Creek, where Patterson and Gimlin made their film. And doing some research, we found out that this woman, Lucy, very well-educated Yurok woman, lived on the Klamath River, and she wrote about her experiences, and they were across the board, how it was living there, how it was trying to get by, some of the perils of living along the river. And then she talked about these things called Indian devils. And the Indian devils are described as coming into their village at night, sometimes stealing food, sometimes waiting until the male warriors left for the day to go kill deer, et cetera. And when they were gone during the day, the Indian devils sometimes would come down and take a woman, take a young girl, take a child. And they would take them for different reasons. And sometimes the warriors would go out and get them back. Sometimes they would find them charred and cannibalized. And it almost sounded as though that it was on a need basis. Sometimes they needed a mate, and they would take one. Sometimes, maybe during a hard winter, they would take one to eat. But there was a consistency in the story when we started to step across the U.S. and talk about other tribes. Same thing was happening in Washington. Same thing was happening in Oklahoma. There is that consistency to the story that cannot be ignored.
Well, when you say that they called them devils, that makes me wonder about the nature of the relationship between Native American tribes and whatever these things are. Because, you know, you read some accounts and they refer to them as our brothers in the forest kind of a thing. And they come and watch over us and help us. And then something like that where they steal children and eat them. That doesn't sound like brothers in the forest.
And that's a good point. And a very well-educated Indian elder once told me, said, Dave, it's sometimes hard to understand and reconcile that. But imagine this. That if you were a group of, say, 50 humans living in a village, and you had a problem child that you couldn't tame and you couldn't take care of, and you excommunicated them from your group and you said, get out of here, you go live someplace else. Well, probably that happened because they couldn't live by your rules. And once they left, they didn't have to live by anybody's rules anymore. So if you can imagine, and I know this is hard for some viewers to grasp, but if you buy the line that Bigfoot, Sasquatch has these human genetics in it, and every once in a while a semi-civilized group excommunicates one and tells them to leave, well, maybe it's that rogue one out there that can't be tamed and can't be civilized out there and does bad things because, hey, we know in human genetics we've got bad people too that do some horrendous things.
Well, you mentioned in the accounts of this Yurok woman, Lucy Thompson, they claim that she alleges that the creature, whatever it's called, is a shapeshifter, that it can change its form, that it can become other animals. And I want you to address that specifically, but also in this context is, do you take this account literally, that she is describing things that really happened, or as more like a folklore?
I think most of it probably really happened. And when Harvey and I went back to Oklahoma, and Harvey has Native American himself, he broke down some ground for us so we could talk to some elders face to face and get what we believe to be the truth about it. There were these shapeshifters, according to the elders back 100 years ago. And as times has moved forward, they're harder and harder to find, although they supposedly do exist. And I think that could have been a way at times for them to reconcile this in their mind, how odd the behavior is, how unusual it is. And trust me, they do have some unusual behavior, and they have some abilities that we don't have. But if you can reconcile that by calling them a shapeshifter, but when you talk to the elders, that's very, very rare, even in their community 100, 200 years ago, to find somebody that could do that. It wasn't common.
Well, shapeshifting, does that account for all the different kinds of descriptions? I mean, you have so many different kinds in the book, Tribal Bigfoot, different colors, different shapes of the head, different look of the face. Are there just a whole bunch of different species? Is that your guess, or sort of offshoots, or do they look different to different people?
Well, let's think about the human race for a second and say,
sure,
if I put you in the middle of Beijing, China, and I said, grab the three closest people to you in Beijing, and then we go to the middle of the Senegal desert, and I say, grab three of the closest people to you, and then we go to an NBA basketball game, and I say, step onto the middle of the NBA floor and grab three of the closest players to you. How different are those people going to look when you stand them next to each other? And if you understand how different human genetics is and how many different races we have in and amongst ourselves, when you start to look at the Bigfoot phenomena, whether it's called Almasti in Russia or Yeti in Nepal, these bipeds exist on every continent and in many, many, many countries. And it's just not a 20th century issue. It goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So if you have that genetic evolution and that change, and if every once in a while they grab a human against their will, as Lucy described, and they use them as a wife, and they try to have kids with them, then eventually those genetics are going to get involved, and everybody's going to look a little different. If all of these Bigfoot looked exactly alike, that would be suspect. But having them have that differentiation that you would find in human genetics, in people, in communities, it makes more sense to us.
I don't want to beat this too much into the ground, but I'd like to go back to these historical cases and ask you to address the significance of historical cases. When you go back hundreds of years, pre-mass media, pre-hysteria kinds of things, when it is obvious that the people who are seeing these things are not trying to sell their story to the National Enquirer, what are they describing, and what is the significance in that in terms of evidence for you?
Well, there's a very famous case where David Thompson was an explorer, and he was up near Jasper, Alberta, Canada in the 1700s. And he got onto some tracks, and he was with guides at the time, and they found these giant human-type tracks with a huge stride in the absolute middle of nowhere. And Thompson wrote about them several times and talked about them later in his life, how he couldn't reconcile what it was. And other people said, oh, it's just a giant grizzly or something, and he came back and he said several times, no, it couldn't have been a grizzly, and it bothered him at that level. Then if you go back to Tule River and you say, well, 1,500 years ago they had these things drawn on walls, and they look identical to what a silhouette of a Bigfoot Sasquatch is today. And if you can think, well, a lot of people put all the relevance into what Jerry Crew named Bigfoot in 1958 up at Bluff Creek, and really it's just been everybody falsifying and hoaxing ever since. But if you go back in the record, even to the starting of newspapers, there are these stories. Trappers in trapper journals. When the people came over on the boats to the California coast, there are talks about them hitting land and running up against hairy giant people. Same thing on the East Coast. And one of the things we did early on was not only did we do our research on the researchers in this field, but we also did that historical search to try to understand how much validity we can put into it before we move forward. And it was overwhelming how much there is. And I put it in tribal because I want people to understand that there is background to this that's that if you just kind of match the lines on a map, just like you match the lines on a pin drawing of crimes, you can see that it starts to make sense. It didn't all happen on the West Coast. It's been going on throughout the United States and Canada for years. There's not one climate or one elevation where they proliferate and they don't exist. They exist sometimes in the desert areas of Southern California.
Well, it's just like other kinds of controversial paranormal mysteries, UFOs. You have a lot of folks who get involved in it and want to mess with other people's minds, hoaxers who maybe want to make a buck or they just want to attention. I remember these guys, what was it, 2 years ago or 3 years ago maybe, who claimed that they had Bigfoot in their freezer, and it was obviously described as a hoax. And then you have cases like the Patterson film, the most famous Bigfoot film, that really has passed a lot of tests and that a lot of people believe to be legitimate, but it also gets thrown into the mix and gets muddied up. Wasn't there somebody who came forward at the deathbed confession that we made it up?
I've heard so many different stories from different people, but what I tell anybody is I say, if you give me 4 hours of your time, I'll make you a believer that that Patterson film is absolutely a photo of a living Harry Biped. Those guys did a phenomenal job. They were unbelievably lucky. And as I've spoke about at conferences, it was like the perfect storm for Bigfoot. These guys not only got a Bigfoot, they got a Bigfoot in the middle of an open area. They got him open for 30, 40, 50 seconds. They found one that was extremely hairy and didn't run. It stood there and walked across an open area. It was next, at the beginning when the film started, it was semi-near a wooded area and could have turned and disappeared into it. For some reason, it didn't. It stayed out in the gravel bed and walked the entire distance and gave him an opportunity to film it. And what I tell people is I say, what are the odds of today a person walking through the woods that has some kind of video device compared to 1967? It's got to be enormous. We all have something in our honest these days that has a video device. But you know what? That film hasn't been duplicated. No one has gotten good footage of a Bigfoot since 1967.
So what are you saying, that that thing wanted to be filmed?
I have no idea. I'm just saying that there's peculiarities about it that strike as highly unusual, and these guys were very, very lucky. Great weather, an open area. It stayed out in the open. They were able to film it. My gosh, how lucky is that?
What about the deathbed confession? Am I remembering that correctly?
Never had one from
Patterson.
From Patterson, no.
I thought there was somebody else in that story who came forward to saying that he was close to them and they had made it up or something.
Now, there's been a few people that have written books trying to take away the credibility, but honestly, once you look at that film frame by frame and you see the muscles move and it flex as it puts its foot down, and there's a couple injuries on it that it would have been impossible to make that in 1967 with the degree of definition that there was. Even today, I think it would be very, very difficult.
I'd like to get your take on the whole idea of hoaxes and who would be threatened by this becoming scientifically proven. You know, you got the UFO field that I deal with quite a bit, and there are those for whom their worldview would be greatly upset. There are national security implications why people would want to muddy those waters, even cover it up, and a lot of evidence to suggest that that has happened. I just wonder who is threatened by a Bigfoot being proven beyond any doubt.
Well, we've talked about that a lot because in the last 6 months, we filed probably 20 or 25 different Freedom of Information Act requests.
Hey, I'll tell you what, David, that music tells us we're taking a break, and it sounded like you're coming up to something good. So hold that thought. We'll get back to it after this on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Before the break, David, I was asking you who might be threatened by Bigfoot's reality being confirmed. You know, why would somebody go out of their way to muddy the waters or belittle the whole thing or ridicule people like you?
That's the million-dollar question, George. And step back a little bit now. I'll give you a broader view of how we got to some of the answers to that question is if you look at the Patterson-Gimlin film, another oddity to it is that they caught a female Bigfoot. And our guess is maybe one out of every 10 sightings by a witness is a female. So it's a rare occurrence. So that's another part of the enigma of that film. So we were in Yakima, Washington, and I was meeting with Patricia Patterson. And Patricia has five plates that were made from the original Patterson-Gimlin film. And these plates are highly developed, meaning the picture that you can get off this plate is probably 10 or 15 times better than taking a photo of the frame of the film. And some people had gone up before us and had it scanned, and they did it at a very low resolution. We took the whole day, and at the absolute highest resolution, we got copies of these scans, and we gave them to some people to study. Well, while I was there, two of us walked into the shop that rented Roger Patterson the camera that took the film. And one of the guys is one of the owner's sons is still there, and I asked him if there's anything unusual that never really came out of this regarding the camera. And he says, well, the most unusual thing is he said when he was 14 years old, the FBI, two agents came inside of his store when he and his dad were working there and asked to see the camera that Roger Patterson rented. And his dad said he didn't have it. And the agent said, well, can you get it? And his dad said, well, I don't know if I can because I'm not exactly sure where it's at. And he said, but why can't I just give you a similar camera and that would probably do the trick for you? And the agent said, no, we want that camera. And he said, well, why do you want that camera? And he said that they wanted to measure the speed that film was set at to understand how fast that biped was walking. And so that was almost 2 years ago now I was there. And we immediately came back and filed a Freedom of Information Act request on the FBI files associated with that request. And we write these very well because we have a couple friends that are agents that told us, if you write specific language, they're going to give you specific things, and if you don't, they're going to give you a lot of garbage. And we rewrote that thing four different times, and four different times the FBI said there's no such record of anybody visiting that shop, no such record of any investigation into Patterson, Gimlin, or the footage. And we have literally probably written 60, 70 different letters about this to them, and they claim that there's nothing and that they've never had an interest in it.
Well, what do you make of that? The alternative being that somebody posing as FBI agents was up there? Or
no.
Do you think it was the FBI?
No, because we've been in other locations and said, and people have told us that the FBI came in and asked them about things related to Bigfoot. And let's go back to that Patterson-Gimlin film for a minute. So there's a certain frame there where the biped turns and looks right at the camera. And one of the plates we have, very high resolution. It's a perfect picture of this thing turning around and looking. So Harvey Pratt is an expert of, say, taking a bank robbery photo where a guy puts on a beard and mustache and goes in and robs a bank. Well, Harvey can go in and take the beard and the mustache off the person and let everyone see what he looks like without the costume on. So we came back and we said, Harvey, can you do this with this picture? He said, yeah. And then he looked at it and he said, whoa, you guys are onto something. So he took the hair off, and it's in Tribal Bigfoot, the drawing. And to me, what it looks like is it looks a lot like a Native American man. And to that point, if you go back to what the Native Americans in Washington and in British Columbia said in the 20s, that this is another tribe, and if you listen to what Lucy said about them interbreeding, it all starts to fall together, that these things have this genetic line. But they also have an enormous ability to have speed and strength that obvious humans don't have.
Well, back to my original question on this point is still the why part of muddying the waters. If the FBI was up there asking for that camera, why? I mean, why is that a threat to anybody? Wouldn't it be just kind of a cool thing and the whole world would go, wow, that's really interesting?
Well, I'm not sure how many viewers or even if you knew this, but back in the Cold War era, Russia was looking at the possibility of using ape and gorilla hybrids as military people. And a lot of the scientists out in Russia that were studying the Almasty or the Bigfoot of Russia thought that there was a possibility that they were trying to maybe use some parallel Almasty as a soldier. So maybe that there was some person in the government that heard that Russia was doing this there and said, well, maybe we should be looking into this as well. But you brought up a good question about why our government would be concerned, or why would they want to keep this a secret? And I think the obvious starts to come out the more you listen to governmental reps' stories about why these things aren't recorded in official docs. And we've talked to a lot of Rangers who have had sightings, and they're told by their supervisors, don't write it down. And I just interviewed a guy the other day, worked for the National Park Service. Supervisor told him, don't write it down. And if you think about the government's control over everything, very rarely does the government ever want to say, we can't control the situation. If there ever is a situation that they can't control, it's Bigfoot in the woods of the world, because they have no control. They may have some knowledge that they're not telling us about, but obviously their speed, their ability to conceal themselves, the ability to use languages that we don't understand, but some Native Americans do. If they said, hey, are we safe out there? How can the government say yes or no if they can't even claim that they exist?
I know you're not crazy about getting into some of the more exotic parts of the Bigfoot story, but there are, you know, kind of some anecdotal indications that these creatures have ESP abilities or other kinds of exotic abilities. Do you take those stories seriously?
I will tell you what the newspaper articles in the 20s said. And a group of three different tribes got together, and they actually held a press conference because they heard that some sheriff was going to go out and hunt these things. And they stated that, hey, they have the ability to mimic animals in the forest. So sounds you may hear really aren't the sounds you may be thinking, like owls and other birds and things, but they're Bigfoots communicating with each other. And they don't look a lot like us, because they're real hairy and they're real big, but generally they're passive unless you try to hurt them or unless you get them mad. So don't go out there and try to hunt them. And then you hear these stories about people, and I've heard so many that they're sleeping in a tent, and they feel the rumble, and that's how it's described many times, of these things walking up at their campsite because they're so heavy, 800-900 pounds. And they feel the earth move a little bit, and then they feel it right next to their tent. And it runs the gamut. What people, they have a feeling of immense fright, so much so that sometimes they can't move. Sometimes there's horrific odor associated with it. Very rarely is the tent ever touched or assaulted, but every once in a while it is. But the general thing is that they can't move. And maybe there is something to that. I don't know. But until we understand it, or until we have some kind of chemical analysis of what's going on in the air or something along those lines, it's really hard to put our finger on what may be causing that. But I do know, because I have been in law enforcement situations myself, I've been pretty scared many times. Not to the point of where I can't move, but maybe your thinking is impaired at some level where, you know, you're maybe not as reacting as fast as you would in a normal situation because you're trying to understand what may be occurring to you. It's hard to say.
Isn't there, back to the Patterson film, isn't there a reaction by the horse or the animals, the pack animals in that film, to what's the creature out there in that field?
Yeah,
or
you know.
Am I remembering that wrong?
No, that's correct. Whether the horse fell or whether Patterson fell off the horse, he did go down on the ground, and that caused a big disruption. If you talk to Native Americans, they will tell you that if you want a better chance of seeing a Bigfoot, you ride in on a horse because your odor, the human odor, is up off the ground. And I interviewed a wife of an individual named Syl McCoy, and Syl was the head of the U.S. Forest Service station in Willow Creek in the 50s and 60s. And Syl was an amateur researcher himself, and he and Bob Titmus one day decided that they were going to try to see a Bigfoot because there were certain tracks that were coming out of the Trinity River at this one location. And these guys were smart enough to get up in a Douglas fir tree 100, 150 feet up out of the air and sit there all night because they knew getting themselves up off the ground, they would have a better chance. And I will tell all researchers out there, that is the correct way to go. Because you talk to natives, you talk to the older researchers, you got to get that odor up off the ground, and a Bigfoot will walk right by. And the best example is you can read dozens of sighting reports from people in deer stands. Hunters right. In deer stands see them.
Before we leave this, the subject of the cover-up or muddying the waters thing, you mentioned that you'd filed all these FOIA requests. Did you ever get anything out of any agency, Park Service or FBI or anyone else that mentions Bigfoot, Sasquatch, anything like this?
We got some, and in one of the books, I included a report from the Army Corps of Engineers out of Washington. That wasn't from a FOIA request. It was more of our own research where they talked about Bigfoot in an almanac that was produced by the Army Corps of Engineers in Washington. And they talked about it like it was a real being, so that was interesting. But we have laid into it heavily in just the last 6 months, just like with a razor-fine edge, asking specific questions on specific issues at specific locations. And this ranger that we interviewed the other day, I got that from a U.S. Forest Service law enforcement officer who heard that this guy had actually seen one. We went and interviewed him. He goes, I'll go on camera with him. I'll explain what happened. But there were three of us in this one area. We all saw one at different times. We were told not to report it. Nobody wanted to hear about it. Why?
Huh. And the paperwork, whatever was there is no paper trail, at least in that case. They were just discouraged.
Correct.
Help me while we're waiting to set things up for Dr. Ketchum to come on, give me the state of the evidence, what exists. I mean, we all know that there are these prints and that moldings have been made, and we know that there are eyewitness reports and police sketches, as in your book, Tribal Bigfoot. We know there's a little bit of film footage. What other kinds of evidence do we have, and what it would be the holy grail? Is it hair?
You know, I honestly think that there's several different factors that could be considered the Holy Grail. Let's look at the footprints for a second. There's an individual named Jimmy Chilcott out of Texas that was a police technician, and there's something called dermal ridges in a person's foot, kind of like the fingerprint of the foot. And in several casts going back decades, he found these dermal ridges in the casts of these large giant prints. And literally, those couldn't be faked or hoaxed. And he made several presentations that I've seen where he said, hey, these are real footprints from a real creature, but they're not made by a human print because the dermal ridges go at an angle that human ridges don't. So that's one thing. Now, hair offers us some real obstacles, and I've got the best lesson of probably anybody out there because I've been at this now for 27 months with Dr. Ketchum and her staff. In a human hair, 95% of human hair has a medulla in it. The medulla is a solid core that goes down the center of the hair, and in that is our DNA. And at the follicle level, there's nuclear DNA. And maybe 4 or 5% of the human hair doesn't have this medulla in it, and it's absent. Well, it's almost opposite for Bigfoot hair. Maybe 98 or 99% of Bigfoot hair, if it has a medulla, the DNA in it is so fragmented, is so minimal, that it's not workable. And until we've got multiple samples, and we tried this over and over again, it just doesn't work. And so what I tell everybody, if you have a hair and it doesn't have a follicle at the end, it's worthless for getting DNA at a Sasquatch Bigfoot level. We need the follicle. And the follicle obviously is the core, the root that goes into the body. And unfortunately, for Bigfoot hairs, very small percentage of these hairs have follicles. Whether it's the way the hair comes out, whether it falls out at some level very easily, we don't know. But we've been lucky. We have some samples out of Oregon, some out of California, some out of Alaska, and some out of Mid-America that are good samples. And that started it off working with Dr. Ketchum. And she has been one person that has shown an exorbitant amount of energy and interest because people that are hair and fiber experts have seen these hairs and they've ruled that they are like nothing else out there in the world. And there's no other animal, there's no other human that could have a hair like this. They look a lot like primate hairs, but there's no primate out there that has this exact kind of hair. And this has been stated before, and this isn't really anything new. But I suppose when she hears it from somebody that she deems credible, and he raises her interest level like he did way back when we started this, and now she starts to get into the DNA extraction from follicles of hairs, and it starts to raise her interest even more when she starts to have some strange returns come back. And I wrote about those in Tribal. And she will explain what those odd ups and downs mean and where we're going today. But we've been lucky. We've got some bone. I just submitted a bone to her the other day. And some other people have brought in some other samples. So we have some tissue samples and some other things that are looking very, very promising.
Well, we'll save that part of the discussion for when she joins us. I'd like to ask you, next couple of minutes before the break, why we don't have certain things, like a carcass, like a skeleton, like, you know, a dead Bigfoot that's shot by a hunter out there, all those kinds of things that the critics demand. Where are they?
So we've come to this resolution just in the last year that there's probably been 40 or 50 cases that we can document where a Bigfoot's been shot. And in many, many cases where one's been shot, a second one has been seen. And there's probably a dozen or more cases where there have been four or more Bigfoot seen at one location. There's a website called Bigfoot Encounters where there's a report in there and 14 Bigfoot were seen at a location. We believe that it's a rare occurrence that a Bigfoot travels alone. They probably are in at least multiples of two and maybe more. And they hide and they stay low and they conceal themselves very well. And it's like one person out at the point and everyone's behind. And if one gets shot, we think others come up, grab it, and take it home. And they leave with it. Now, early on when I was in Hoopa, elders told me, they took me out on the reservation, and they showed us where on the reservation these things lived, in the most inhospitable areas you can imagine, way up in rocks, crevices, places researchers won't go, don't want to go. And recently we've had a series of sightings way up on granite ledges that where climbers were climbing and happened to see one. So all of a sudden this is starting to make sense to us that obviously, they want to conceal themselves, they want to stay away from us, and they want their privacy. So why not make it in a location where we will never go? That's number one. Number two is every Native American tribe we have interviewed says that they bury their own. And If they watch what Native Americans do, if they mimic their behavior, if they are a tribe in and of themselves, if they do take their own people when they're injured and they leave with them, that all starts to make sense.
It certainly does. David Politis is my guest. We'll be joined in a couple of minutes after the break by Dr. Melba Ketchum to talk about the search for DNA evidence in confirming the existence of Sasquatch, otherwise known as Bigfoot. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. David Politis is my guest talking about tribal Bigfoot, his excellent book on this topic. We're joined now by Dr. Melba Ketchum. She has a doctorate in veterinary medicine, founded a company called DNA Diagnostics, which does DNA testing on human and animal forensics, and also specializes in species identification, which certainly fits the bill what we're talking about tonight. Dr. Ketchum, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I have to wonder, are you crazy to get involved in something like this? This can't possibly help your reputation.
Oh, probably.
Have you caught any grief, even the limited amount of work that you've done on it?
I was pretty well established before this came along, so at this point it doesn't matter what other people think.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Are you hooked on the story, on the mystery?
Somewhat. I was a total skeptic, I would say. A little more than a year ago, I was a total skeptic. And that has since changed.
What changed it?
Some unusual findings on some of the research we've done.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, last year, Dave's group sent in some samples, and frankly, we started getting these samples back in 1995, and we've fiddled with them all these years, and they always come out either a raccoon or a horse or something common, and I've never had any of them to turn out like I thought they might. So I decided, okay, apes run on human primers or human tests, and if these things are apes, they'll show up, and if they're human, they'll show up. So I started just screening these things for convenience sake, and one of Dave's samples showed up with a very strange peak in a location that it shouldn't have been, and it was a visual male, and it was a sex marker, and it showed up as a female with a peak where it was not supposed to be located. And I reran the thing, and it still showed an unusual band there or peak there. And so I decided that, you know, this is not normal. And, of course, one sample is not going to help. And regrettably, I used up the DNA because, as Dave referred to earlier, these samples are very – the hair samples are hard to get a good yield of DNA from. And at that time, I didn't believe in it, so I just screened right through it. And this kind of changed my mind, and I was a little more curious about it at that point.
When you talk about it peaking, you mean peaking like on a chart?
The electropherograms, which is a graphic representation of the DNA fragment.
David, where did you get this particular sample?
This one came out of Northern California, right on the Oregon border.
And how did you get it? I mean, you just found that somebody found it on a fence, and why would you associate it with a Bigfoot?
Well, the first one we had came out of a story in Hoopoe where a woman lived on the perimeter of the reservation. And in the middle of the night, she had a perimeter motion light go on. She looked out the window, and she saw something rummaging through her garbage pile on the side yard. And she just saw a couple of arms hanging over the side, and she thought it was some kind of prowler. And her brother-in-law was a police officer on duty, so she called, and she said there was a prowler out there. So they responded to police officers. He went out, they said, "We'll try to get a better description." So she walked over to the door and looked out the side. Saw it was a Bigfoot leaning over the top of this metal shed, rummaging through her bags of garbage, and. She heard the sirens coming, lights were coming, and just as these guys were pulling into the yard, the Bigfoot went into the Douglas fir trees, and one of the sergeants has since died, but the other one that was still alive, the guy told me it was one of the most scary things he ever had encountered, because as he got out of the car, he could still feel the earth moving from this thing walking maybe 100 feet away in the woods.
David had told me, Dr. Ketchum, David had told me that you have been partially influenced in your willingness to proceed with this kind of research by comments made by some of your colleagues. And David, I know in Tribal Bigfoot, you mentioned this guy, Dr. Rogers, who was, I guess, out with the Monster Quest team. And he came to the opinion that a hair sample that he had was, quote, like no other hair he has seen, doesn't match mammals' hair in North America, certainly isn't a bear, and it looks kind of human. Is that part of the opinion that Dr. Ketchum helped change your mind?
Well, I've got a team assembled of really high-quality scientists. And the way we've set this thing up, we do have all hair samples screened by a forensic supervisor who does hair on a regular basis. And yes, some of the samples that we receive are not real, and he knows it right away. But those that he cannot identify, they go into the actual program. And yes, there are hairs that can't be identified.
So how do you reconcile that? Meaning they can't identify them, it's something we just don't know what it is, or you just don't have enough of a sample, or a combination of the two, or what?
Well, they have certain human characteristics about them, and then they turn around and they also have animal characteristics. It's a strange, and in light of trying to be without an opinion, we call them just unknowns. And at that point, then they go into the DNA. Where, you know, we actually can do species ID.
How many of those do you have?
Oh, quite a number. I actually haven't counted them recently, but there's quite a few.
And what other explanations would there be? What's the range of explanations that you think would be possible or on your list?
Well, maybe just aberrant hair that's not really growing normally from another animal or something, but there's really not a lot of explanation to cover it because hair analysts are usually pretty doggone good at least narrowing down the different species.
So so David was telling us that you need a hair with a follicle, right? Do you have one of those?
Yes, we have a few of those. More without than with, though, regrettably. We actually like to see a little tissue tags hanging on the end of the root. Those are the ones that are just really premium as far as for giving us the DNA we need at this point.
Let's do a hypothetical here. Let's say you get a clump of hair. It's got some follicles on it. You run the test and DNA. Is there such a thing as a positive, proof positive that this is some other kind of primate species?
Well, we can't go there verbally at this time. Let's just say that we've got some fairly compelling evidence so far, but we're going to nail the coffin shut before we publish because we want to make sure that skeptics can't question anything we've done. We're doing these like forensic cases.
Okay. Well, I understand that you don't want to let the cat out of the bag about anything you have right now. I'm just wondering, in a hypothetical, a general sense, is there a way that you can prove it beyond any doubt?
Yes.
And would it be that if you can't identify what the species is, I wonder how do you prove that it is like a Bigfoot then?
Well, you're going to compare it to other species and see what it's similar to.
Right.
And, just hypothetically, if it shows more in its DNA sequence, it shows more ape bases, then you could say, well, it's a type of ape. If it shows something aligning more with human, then you would say, you know, it's a new brand of human. And if it's, somewhere in between, you might consider it a cross. Or if it's got ancient bases, you could call it a Neanderthal or a Neanderthal cross.
Wow, that's fascinating. And can you tell me what the protocol would be? I deal a lot with the UFO topic, and I always wonder what would happen if they had confirmed evidence of something like that. What was the protocol that you would follow if you nailed it down?
Well, the first thing we do, like I say, is we validate everything we're doing first. We make sure it's working. And then we come in with our unknown samples, and we take pictures of them, measure them, do everything to catalog them, just like you would a forensic case. Make sure chain of custody is as intact as you can get it. And then you start with your testing. As soon as we get them back, if it's hair, we get it back from the hair analyst. Then we move forward with usually mitochondrial testing, which is, of course, maternally inherited. It comes from your mother. And that gives you species ID information. It gives you... it just gives you a lot of information, quite frankly. Origins of the maternal lineage. And then once that's completed, then you would go forward into nuclear testing.
Well, let's say, though, you follow all those steps. You've got it down. You're convinced you've got the real deal there. How do you announce it to the world, or do you?
Oh, yeah, we'll announce it.
Would you hold a news conference, write a paper?
Yeah. Well, both. There'll be a peer-reviewed paper produced. Because that's the only way to do it right. And, furthermore, we're having our work is being back-checked from independent sources. And
well,
kind
sounds
of like
to
a
me
blind
like,
study.
Yeah, sounds to me like this. We're not talking hypothetical here, that you're down the road without spilling too many beans.
We are down the road with it.
Oh, wow, that's exciting. Now, David, you mentioned something about a bone sample. Tell me about that, where you got it, and what you think you have.
Well, honestly, we weren't quite sure what we have. I'm not an expert at that. And it was given to us, and it was found in a creek bed up in Oregon. And I let some people look at it that were familiar with human skeletons. They said it was too big for that, and I'm not too familiar with animals, and Dr. Ketchum is, so I forwarded it up to her, and I think it's right now under review, and it has some interest.
Dr. Ketchum, can you add anything to that?
The bone's huge.
Is it? Yeah?
I mean, you know, it's just only a couple of things it could be. And that's without going into any analysis on it.
Is bone better than hair?
Not necessarily. Skeletal remains usually are degraded, especially those that may have come from a creek bed. And therefore, you know, you have to work really hard to get any DNA out of them. And usually when you get it, it's only the mitochondrial DNA. And that is not enough to do a full spectrum test. So it'll give us information, yes. I think we'll be able to, due to the number of samples we have, we'll be able to place it where it needs to be placed. As far as getting a yes or no definitive answer on it, I'm not sure at this point. It'll just depend on how degraded the DNA is when we get into it.
Help me paint a picture for me about how this might be received. Let's say you write this paper. It's reviewed by your colleagues. You got double-blind studies and tests and all this, and you've really nailed it down. Can you get something like that published in a journal, a scientific journal?
Oh, I think so. I think as long as you, you know, cross your T's and dot your I's and do things in a proper scientific fashion, that it'll go just like the Neanderthal paper did.
Would you call it Bigfoot? What would you call it?
would you
even put a name to it? Because that'd be kind of scary, wouldn't it?
We've got some names we've kind of knocked around, but, you know, there's not – it'll take it. Because one thing I want to brag about is that all these people that have submitted samples, they're wonderful people. And they're coming together for the first time, I think, ever, because, you know, there's a lot of rivalry in the Bigfoot organizations. And I've found that, you know, the people that I'm working for at this point, that they're all just really wanting to get to the bottom of it, and they're wanting to work together. And I'm sure some of this will be consensus stuff when we get down to the very end.
Well, I hope you're right about the you'll have no trouble getting it published. I just have had a lot of feedback from scientists studying exotic sorts of topics who dot the I's and cross the T's and do what they're supposed to do, and they run into considerable resistance when it's something controversial like this. I guess part of it would be labeling and how you label it. If you announce the discovery of some unknown, previously unknown primate and don't mention the size of its feet, you might get away with it.
Well, George, think about this. This approach has never been utilized before. So we have a sample coming out of HOOPA. We send a trained forensic artist out, interviews the witness. She shows where the hair was. The hair wasn't there the night before. She sees the biped lean over. The hair is pulled off the biped as it pulls the garbage bag over. The artist sits down, draws what she observed. The hair is recovered. The hair is sent to the lab. Now we have this trail with this drawing of what left it. Now we have a trained PhD going after the DNA at a scientific, sterile level. Really, this approach has never been used before.
David, you're not maybe under the same scientific or professional constraints that Dr. Ketchum is. Can you give me some hints about how far down the road this will be, and will you be part of whatever this announcement is?
I hope so. I mean, we've been at this longer than I think almost anyone, and we'll continue to try to take samples to Dr. Ketchum when we think that they're valuable, and give her our support. And I can guarantee, as I've told the people that have written to us in the past, that, and I've learned this from Dr. Ketchum, that you can't push science. What we thought might have been a 3 or 4 month cycle to get to the end has really, really taken a lot longer. And it's a testament to her and the people that we're working with that they're trying to do this the right way, because when the people come back and they try to second guess us, that they'll be able to stand behind the results.
What she mentioned about rivalries in the field, you've had to run into that yourself?
You know, of course you do. And there's been some great researchers in the past, and there have been some people that call themselves researchers, but they aren't really doing research. And when we got into this, we had most of us came from business before, technology, law enforcement, whatever. We wrote a business plan about how we were going to approach this, and we've stuck to that plan. And when Dr. Ketchum comes out with the results, we're done. And the reality behind this is that we're not going to make this a lifelong pursuit like some other people have. We're in this to get results, and then we're going to move on to our next lifelong ambition, whatever that may be. But people can Monday night quarterback us. They can call us names. They can say, oh, we don't have any friends, and you're not working with anybody. That's fine. And the reality is this is the first time we've come forward and ever introduced the world to really what we're doing at that DNA level.
Dr. Ketchum, what about the expense? I mean, this DNA testing, that's pretty expensive stuff from what I understand. How are you covering that, or are you just eating it?
Well, I've eaten my time on it, but I've made everybody fork out at least something to go toward the consumables. And it hasn't been cheap, and, you know, we still, in fact, we have a nonprofit for this very purpose. For that reason, when we get donations, you know, that way they can write them off on their taxes. But, you know, we're running on donations on this, quite frankly.
Well, tell me more about that, because this is the first I've heard of it. If there's somebody in the audience who wants to have more information on that, where do they go?
They can contact Dave. Dave is, rather than overload us here at the lab, he's kind enough to, you know, people that have maybe samples they might want to submit or people that are inquiring about making a donation to the research project, they can contact Dave. And I'm sure you can provide them with his contact information there.
And do you get much interest in that, David?
Absolutely. There's a lot of people out there that are very well educated that have been very reticent to be involved in this field for a variety of reasons. But to see somebody come forward and a group come forward with a methodical approach, a scientific approach, a lot of people are starting to come out of the woodwork now and are starting to participate where they didn't want to before. And there haven't been many scientific professionals that have stuck their nose into this for a variety of reasons. But now we're starting to see some involvement, and that is refreshing.
That's amazing. I know the only other name that comes to mind for me is Dr. Jeff Meldrum, the guy from Idaho State, who's been interviewed on a couple of programs, who's had courage in coming forward and saying he's interested in this research. In your book, in Tribal Bigfoot, you tell a story at the end about where he's up in the woods, I guess, with some TV show, Monster Quest or something, and they had some sort of an encounter out there?
Yeah, Snowgrove Lake up in Canada. That's actually a great episode because you could see on their faces they were concerned. They were in the middle of nowhere. They flew into this lake on a float plane, and they started to have some rocks thrown at them on a tin roof. And the gentlemen there, including Dr. Meldrum, they looked concerned.
I think the way you describe it is they all got in the building and hid out and locked the doors and got the heck out of there. All right, well, we'll continue our conversation with Dave Politis and Dr. Melba Ketchum. We're going to the phones for your questions right after these breaks and these messages on Coast to Coast AM. We're in the home stretch with our guests talking about Bigfoot, going to the phones west of the Rockies, Rich in Washington, up there in Bigfoot territory. And I think, Rich, you may know the guests.
Yeah, I do.
Hi, Rich.
You still there, Rich?
Yeah, I'm here.
What's on your mind?
I'm working with Dr. Ketchum, and I'm pretty good friends with Dave. I talk to him quite a bit. We have a camera trap project we're doing on the Olympic Peninsula called the Olympic Project, and I've sent a couple of samples to Dr. Ketchum in relation to some other evidence that we've collected. And I know I talked to Dave, and he said that I could go ahead and call in. I don't really have a question, but I don't know if they want to talk about it or if they have anything to add or anything like that.
Well, George, I have. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, Rich is doing a fantastic job up there. He's in prime Bigfoot area, and they have some very good cameras that they've set up along ridgelines and in prime area. And their team has gotten some very interesting results and some very interesting photos out of there. Nothing that you would say, oh, yeah, that's a Bigfoot for sure. But he's just gotten some great pictures, some great results that he's set on. Dr. Ketchum, a very credible guy and working with some credible people.
I remember in your book, David, you call in Tribal Bigfoot, you refer to these creatures as ridge walkers. Is that, Rich, is that why you're putting your cameras up on the ridges, because that's where they roam?
We had some interesting – I had a sighting some years ago, and I've kind of been interested in the topic, and then I got tied up with a guy named Derek Randles, who lives nearby me, and we got into it together. Well, he'd been doing it for a long, long time, but, you know, I got in contact with him, and we got going on this project, and I found tracks on top of a ridge about 3 or 4 years ago, actually less than that, a couple of years ago, and we started thinking about it and trying to figure out, trying to funnel these things down and try to figure something out with them about migration or what kind of terrain that they use to travel to avoid people or whatever they're doing. And we decided on these ridge lines because they're the tops of the they're the easiest place to travel, basically, in the woods, in the steep terrain, like in the Olympic Mountains here. It's wide open, and it's obvious. It's an animal highway on top of there, and we thought, well, it makes perfect sense that these things would use these to travel from one place to another, because it's the fastest way to get somewhere. And they can do it without detection because people don't normally walk on top of these ridges. It's really hard to get to them. They're off trail, off roads, and they're relatively safe. And we ended up finding some evidence to support what we thought with tracks. And we've got about 40 cameras. We've been doing this for about a year and a half. And, yeah, like Dave said, we have some really interesting results. We've got some photographs. I mean, we're pretty sure about what we have. I mean, it's up to the individuals that want to look at them to decide for themselves. But we took some swabs off one of our cameras where we got some interesting photos, and they're working with that stuff now. And we've collected hair, found tracks, pretty much all kinds of stuff. We think that we're going to have good results over the term of the project, and we plan on it being quite long-term.
Well, Rich, that sounds really promising. I hope when you get further down the line and you got something definitive to say, you'll keep Coast to Coast in mind, come back on the show and tell us about it.
Yeah, we have a website that has a lot of our stuff up there.
What is it? Go ahead and say.
It's www.olympicproject.com.
All right, we'll take a look. Rich, thanks for calling in. We're going to East of the Rockies, Terry in South Carolina. Hi, Terry.
Hi, George. I just wondered if you all had ever heard of Nobby up in Kayser, North Carolina.
It's David?
No, I've never heard that term, but I've heard a few others for that part of the country.
Well, they call it Nobby up in near, it's in Cleveland County. We just had a sighting this last month, about a month ago. A gentleman was playing with one of his homemade animal calls. He's a hunter, and he claims he was out using this call, and basically Bigfoot just came up out of the woods to him. And he was pretty intent that it had beautiful hair, beautiful long hair. But it made it on local news. I didn't know if y'all had heard about it. It was on Channel 3 and 36 and most of the major local stations around here. But it happened up in Cleveland County. Even called in on the Cleveland County 911 if y'all want to check into that or anything.
So Nobby is like a regional nickname?
Yeah, it's, you've got basically we're in the foothills section out near where I live. We're not exactly up in the mountains, but anyway, it's the foothills. You know what I mean? And in the foothills, you've got higher peaks, and we usually just term those as knobs. They're not really tall enough to be a mountain, but not big enough. They're a little bigger than a hill, so we'll call them a knob. It's just a regional terminology.
Terry, we appreciate the call. David, anything to add to that? You want to talk to this guy further?
Other than he's in prime Bigfoot country, and any type of sighting coming out of there has some validity to it just because there's so many out there.
Okay, we appreciate the call. We're going to go to our wildcard line, Christian in Los Angeles. Hi, Christian. Good morning.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Hello, my name is Christian. I've called him before, and I have a first thing I want to add is that I've had an interest in Bigfoot or Sasquatch for years, and I've kept up with it very well, been very current. And I always, in the beginning, I always thought that the Bigfoot sightings were in, like, the Pacific Northwest. And I was really surprised over time that, really, Sasquatch sightings have been sighted all the way from the Pacific coast of the United States across the country to Texas, Louisiana, to Florida. So they migrated, I guess, over the millennia all over the country, and they're able to remain hidden. The second question I had were for your guest this evening, and that is that I have never heard or read anything of a Sasquatch deliberately going out of their way and harming people. And that's why when I was watching the History Channel Monster Quest episode, and as you said earlier, there was the expedition up in Canada in Snow Grove Lake at that fishing cabin, which was isolated out in the middle of nowhere. And Jeff Meldrum and several other researchers said that they literally, and other people that who've been up there on fishing expeditions, felt that in the summer months, which is, I guess, the prime active time, that they literally felt that the Sasquatch in the region didn't want anybody there. And what do you think about this pattern of aggressive behavior in that one particular region? And I just wanted to say thank you for taking your time.
Okay, Christian, thank you.
I don't think it's one particular area. That pattern of showing aggression, whether it's through a scream, a yell, or whether it's through rock throwing, that's pretty consistent across the entire U.S. and Canada. And you might be treading on their privacy or their hunting area, and they want you out of there, and they're going to try to intimidate you to get you out. And they usually throw small rocks, stones. Very rarely does it even ever hit anybody, but it's more of an intimidation than anything else.
And as for the hurting anyone, I guess we covered that sort of earlier in the interview. There are at least some anecdotal cases mentioned by Native Americans that there have been people harmed.
Certainly.
Okay. Wildcard line, Andrew, also in L.A. Hi, Andrew. Good morning.
Hi, George. I love your deep and probing questions. You're an excellent interviewer. And Dr. and David, two quick questions. Number one, let's see. Grand Canyon area several years ago, doctor going on a hiking expedition there with his family, and he encountered a Bigfoot. Allegedly, he had his recorder on. And was there any follow-up information as to his credibility and any additional information on that? And secondly, approximately within 15 years, I wish I could give you a better timeline, I saw on late-night TV after midnight in Los Angeles, a film footage on the news after midnight in which some anonymous donor gave the news department a clip of some night vision footage of a Bigfoot. And it was very, very clear. He must have had some excellent quality equipment. The footage showed a creature big, very big. Very primitive looking and very alert and aware, and even in the darkness was looking in all directions, like super awareness of what was around him. And have you ever run across or heard about that film footage? And I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
There actually has been some excellent night vision and FLIR footage that's been taken of Bigfoot. And it's just like the caller explained. If you can imagine an army soldier on speed, methamphetamine, and he's moving his head right to left, up and down, staying low to the ground, on cover, behind a tree, always looking. That's exactly the way it is. They stay low to the ground. They stay behind cover. They look every once in a while. They're very nervous. It's exactly the way it is.
Hey, Dr. Ketchum, thanks, Andrew, for that call. Dr. Ketchum, I had a question for you. Are you reluctant to sort of delve into the Bigfoot library to read all the books? Are you familiar with other kinds of evidence that maybe is not in your area of specialty, like the dermal ridges, for example, that was mentioned by David earlier? Or do you have to keep yourself away from that stuff so you don't sort of get too biased about the whole thing?
Oh, no, I read it. I have to admit I read it. I don't like it when I don't know what somebody's talking about, so I've educated myself. I don't think I have to worry about being biased because the DNA is either going to, you know, do it or not do it. It's just that simple. And the DNA doesn't lie. So, it doesn't matter whether I'm biased or not because I can't affect the outcome of the results. And also, I have a really true skeptic PhD on my team that just absolutely believes they don't exist, and he keeps everybody kind of on the straight and narrow. And then I have two other PhDs that they waffle a little bit, but mostly I think they're leaning towards belief, It's an interesting group I have. They're all very well known and very credible individuals. So it's going to be a really nice thing when we get it all put together.
Well, it's a very cool thing to have a team like that put together. I mean, you're supposed to be skeptical. You're a scientist, but skeptical doesn't mean I refuse to believe. It's that if I believe something to be true, it has to be based on proof, right?
That's right, and that's what I'm saying. The proof is in the DNA, not in anything I believe or, you know, any of my personal feelings toward anything.
Well, I can't wait to hear what this is about. Wildcard Line, Dan in Maryland. Good morning, Dan. Dan's not there. How about our first-time caller? Is Justin up there in Reno?
Yep, that's me.
Hey, Justin, how you doing? What's on your mind?
Well, I have a quick question. The yelling of the Sasquatch, a guitar has a tempo. You can tell by its, you know, the vocals. Like, there's got to be some type of way that you can identify the Sasquatch with the vocals and then set with, like, a tempo. Is there any type of instrument out there that would actually identify the Sasquatch to any other type of animals? And then if you can identify that Sasquatch's vocal cords, I should say, there's got to be some type of way to visually see this type of creature that's doing this sound. Everything has a different type of a vibe, I should say, like a bass. This stand up, it's big and it has a very deep, noise. With like a violin, it's very small and it has a very pitch noise. I was just kind of wondering, like, is there something else that we can actually attain from the vocal cords or the noises from Sasquatch itself, I should say? And I was hoping that George and David had a great question or an answer for this. Because, you know, I'm from the West Coast, and I actually came from the East Coast. And I actually heard this sound twice from two different areas. And, I play the guitar, and I like to associate everything with music. So I'm kind of wondering, is there a way to actually get the tempo of the vocal?
Well, let's find out. Justin, that's a good point. David, have you ever done any vocal analysis of any recordings?
You know, others have. And, in fact, they took it to some wildlife labs that have the spectrum of every animal's range in their bark, scream, whatever. And the results came back that it was outside the spectrum of anything that they'd had on file. And they couldn't define it. So the caller was on the right track. It's one of those things where it's not on file. They proved it couldn't have been a man-made sound. That was another thing that came back. So it was made by something that was living, but they didn't have it filed.
Dr. Ketchum, I noticed in your resume it said you specialize in species identification. Would that be a kind of a piece of evidence that you would consider?
Well, we do DNA, not vocal analysis. But there's been some really good work on that out there by other people. And, you know, I'm sure you go on the net, you can find it. There's even an alphabet out there now.
All right, we're going to try to get one more call in. East of the Rockies, Jody in North Dakota. You got to be quick on this one, Jody.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I will certainly try.
Okay.
One of the questions I wanted to ask your guest, David, was in exploring the Bigfoots being around the reservation areas where the native tribes are, has he explored the fact that maybe there's some connection between the native people and the creatures?
Absolutely. And if you go back to the belief that they are another tribe in and of themselves, and they've lived around other Native American tribes for hundreds, if not thousands of years, then there's a certain comfort and respect level. And we think that the closer they stay to those tribal areas, the less that they're molested and bothered and annoyed. And there's a somewhat give and let give relationship by all these tribes towards the Bigfoot. This time, there isn't a lot of kidnapping. There isn't a lot of people being taken and stolen from the reservations. And so it appears as though it's more of a harmonic relationship right now. But those are our thoughts, and that's one of the reasons that we pursued the reservation research.
Thanks, Jody, for the call. We've got about a minute left here. Can you give me sort of a synopsis? What's coming next? What kind of a time frame? When we might hear something from the two of you? Dr. Ketchum, I'll start with you.
Well, it just depends on how good the research continues. It could be as early as a month or so, or it could be a little longer.
You will come back and talk to me about it, won't you?
Oh, sure.
Are you enthusiastic and are you optimistic?
I'm very optimistic and very enthusiastic at this point.
Well, this could be gigantic. I mean, it just could be. This is, could be worldwide news.
Well, we'll find out, won't we?
David, parting thoughts from you?
I would tell your listeners that for the people that are involved at some level, that maybe have some strange type of visitors in the middle of the night, and they have a hair sample laying around, send it in to us. It's under our contact information on our website. We'll gladly let you participate. We'll keep you updated. We'll put the specimen under your name, and we'll send it on to Dr. Ketchum.
I would rather have tissue or samples or something with more tissue to it if possible.
All right. Dr. Melba Ketchum, thanks very much. David Paulides, always good to have you on the program. Also, my thanks to our earlier guest, Dr. Robert Lanza. Thank you all for sticking with us, and I'll be back next month. Good night, everyone.